This is Norman B's Life Elsewhere, the show about art, media, and culture.
Hello there, I'm Norman B. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I have a very special show for you, an intimate, an in-depth interview with a musician who very kindly agreed to take time out from his busy schedule to chat. As a way of introduction, I'm going to start the show with a piece of music that's not only instantly recognizable, it was also groundbreaking at the time of its release. Now, take a listen and see if you can figure out who my guest is before I introduce him. David J is a name that anybody that's been around the music business for a few years is going to recognize immediately. I was having coffee just a half an hour ago, and I said to the barista, "I'm going to be talking to David J in a little while." And he just got all giddy. He got all sort of silly all for a moment. He said, "Oh my God, Bauhaus!" And I hear this all the time. Well, it just so happens I've got David J on the telephone line with us right now. David, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Hello, thank you very much.
It's really interesting, you know, because the name Bauhaus seems to have, it rings so many memories for so many people. I remember, and I was going to give you a little story, I remember getting a white copy, a blank label, came back from London with it and played it on the air of Bela Lugosi's Dead, and nobody at the time had ever heard a song that was about 10 minutes long, and they just thought it was nuts, but they loved it. I remember the very first time I played it, people just loved it. We're going back a long time, aren't we?
We're going back to 1979, and certainly we submitted that track to a lot of independent record labels, and they thought it was nuts as well, being so long. And in fact, this was starting to be, it was getting drummed into our heads to such a degree that we started to sort of doubt it ourselves. You know, are we really crazy here trying to put out a single this long? Until we took it to Pete Stennett, bless him, at Small Wonder, and we voiced this concern, and he said, "You're joking. This is a future classic." He said, and it's like he compared it to the Velvet Underground's Sister Ray. And he said, "You want to hear every minute of that Sister Ray, and in a similar way, you want to hear every minute, every second of Bela Lugosi's Dead. So no, don't edit it. I'm putting it out like this, and you know, he was right, and we were right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right in the end.
You know, this is going to sound like a strange comparison, but the only other thing, the only record at the time that I thought it reminded me, it's nothing like it at all, but was Van Morrison's Astral Weeks and Madam George, the track from Van Morrison's Astral Weeks, which went on and on and on, and it had that sort of breakdown in it. And then when I heard Bela Lugosi's Dead, it sort of reminded me of the length, but just how intricate it was. And you just said something so important. You said you wanted to listen to every second of it, and you really did. Such a great record, and it stands up to the test of time, David, yeah?
You just mentioned one of my all-time favourite tracks, that Van Morrison track, Madam George.
Oh, yeah.
I love that. And that album, incredible, incredible work. And it's amazing to think that he met the musicians in the studio.
Yes.
And he actually, I mean, apparently he had no actual conversations with them, apart from the incredible musical conversation that is recorded on the record.
I know, the
musicians found him very odd.
Yes.
And you know, I've heard a lot of stories, you know, that support that.
Yes.
But I kind of understand it, you know, and it's a magical album, that Astral Weeks.
David, on Facebook, I was looking through, I was just doing some little research about you, and I went to your Facebook page, and it says, founding member of Bauhaus and Love and Rockets, now flying solo, with the help of talented friends. I thought that was just such a concise and such a wonderful thing to say. Do you like being sort of mentioned as Bauhaus and Love and Rockets every time you talk to an interviewer?
Well, I expect it, and I'm proud of both of those bands, so I don't mind it at all, you know, and it's part of my, it's a crucial part of my history. And so, no, so long as it doesn't end there.
Right.
Because I'm always expanding and experimenting and collaborating with other artists. So, no.
In the NME just recently, I think I saw it yesterday, there is, and it says, David J. Comment, this is not a Bauhaus tour, talking about the tour you're on right now. This is not a Bauhaus tour, but rather two of the founding members, namely Peter and myself, stepping out in our 40th anniversary. Does it bother you then when the NME or anybody says it's a Bauhaus tour?
That quotation, that quote was made in response to some of the fans out there perceiving that we, Peter and I, were putting this tour across as Bauhaus, which was never the case. And I was just sort of clarifying that issue, just saying, you know, no, it's not Bauhaus, and it would be completely wrong to call it that. It is what it is. It's two of the original members with two other really talented musicians, John Andrews and Mark Slutsky. And we're on guitar and drums, respectively, and we're encouraging them to bring their own characters to the arena of the music, you know, to bring. So it's not just aping what's on the record. That would be boring, and also not well advised. So it's a little bit different. I mean, we think it has the essence of that music, the original, but also it takes it somewhere else, which keeps it very alive for all of us. You know, so there's an injection of new sort of vitality into the whole thing.
Yeah, I love that. If you don't mind, can we go back in time just a little bit, back to those days, those early days in Northampton? You had no clue at the time that you would be 40 years later talking about music that you were making right then. Just looking back, David, at the time, as a young man, as a young fledgling rock and roll musician, did you have stars in your eyes? What was going on for David J at the time?
Well, we thought we had something special in the band. We really had no clue as to how long it would last. And we were also aware that it was pretty underground, you know. We weren't trying to make commercial music. We weren't interested in that. We're really trying to please ourselves.
Yeah.
And we're trying to create a sound that we'd never heard before. Something that was unique, and I believe we did that, you know. But I am, in retrospect, I'm surprised, you know, it became as universally popular.
Yes.
As it did.
Yes.
For an underground, you know, weird kind of angular avant-garde post-punk band, yeah.
Now, did you think of yourselves as weird, as sort of different to what was going on? You managed to sort of have that image, but did you actually think of yourselves like that?
Yeah, we did, but it wasn't contrived, you know.
Right.
It was just, we were just being ourselves.
Yes, yeah.
And we were just, it was just the music that was coming out of us. It was very natural and organic, and it's just, we, that was who we were, you know. So it was real, and I think that's part of the popularity of the band, is because the audiences, they pick up on that. They respond to the authenticity. And we will certainly be authentic.
Now, because you had Bela Lugosi on one side and Dark Entries on the other side, and then when you bring out the first album, there was a lot of sort of, I guess, sort of gloomy kind of references, and people immediately started to sort of get an idea that this was, it became to be known as goth. But at the time, there was no such genre as goth. Can you remember how that started to come about?
Some writer coined the phrase in a music paper, you know, and it's a sort of easy label. But we were kind of frustrated by it, because we were very ambitious and also eclectic in our tastes, and we wanted to expand, and we did expand.
Yes.
And we drew from all sorts of genres, so we didn't want to be limited by a label, especially one that was, you know, so specific as that.
Yes.
But I can understand why we were labelled as such. But yeah, there was so much more to the band, and each album that came out became more expressive and more expansive.
Yes.
If you listen to it, I mean, there's funk in there, there's dub reggae, there's even like a kind of twisted disco. Yeah, some electronic influences were into bands like, really early bands like Suicide, Can, a lot of the krautrock bands.
Also, one of the things always struck me about the early, particularly the early recordings, and specifically Bela Lugosi's Dead, was your bass playing. It seemed to me that it was at the fore. And when you were in the studio recording, was that deliberate, or how did that come about?
But it often be the case that when we were rehearsing and we were writing the tracks, I would just start playing the bass kind of like a lead.
Yes.
You know, and I'd often initiate the track. That would be kind of the MO, although it was unspoken.
Right.
It's just the way it happened. And I'd start playing a line that was very prominent on the bass. And then Daniel would then come in with something that was kind of textural and rhythmic, and then Kevin would sort of lock in with me, but also be responding to Daniel. And Kevin's is a very original drummer. And then Peter, on top of this soundscape, would take the lyrics. Sometimes I would write them, like Bela Lugosi's Dead, or sometimes, more often than not, he would write them.
Right. Yes.
And then he would just spontaneously kind of riff on top of this musical background, and it would be very instantaneous. Most of the tracks that we did were very instant.
You know, I'm going to make
Bela
another
Lugosi being a good example.
I'm going to make another reference, David, and see if you can agree with me on this one. When I first played Bela Lugosi's Dead, particularly in the radio station, and I've got these great huge monitors in the station, so I'm hearing it for the very first time, really loud, and it's so incredible hearing it so loud. And I'm thinking to myself, this production is there's a rawness about it, but there's a very very controlled feel about it. But at the same time, there seemed to be this sort of almost, I guess the only way, as you just said, it was spontaneous. And it reminded me of the story that I'd heard about how Elvis Presley had recorded Heartbreak Hotel in the stairway of a recording studio to get that echo. I know that you didn't record it in a stairway, but it had that same kind of sort of real spontaneity to it. Any thoughts about that?
Well, every time we've played that particular piece, it's been different.
Yeah.
And when we play it live, to this day, it's always different because there's a certain amount of improvisation that goes on with it. So we just captured in the actual recording that's on the record, that was just one version. And that we could never emulate that exactly. It was always different. And I think that's part of the magic of that track, is that it's open to that improvised element, you know?
Yes.
So, you know, that's integral to it, yeah. More than any other track.
Right. We're going to take a quick break, David, and then when we come back, I'm going to throw a name to you. We're going to sort of change direction here for a moment.
Okay.
I'm just going to say the name right now, then we're going to take a break. David Bowie. We'll talk to David J right after this.
You're listening to the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David J, founding member of Bauhaus and Love and Rockets, and he's now, as he says, flying solo with the help of talented friends. David Bowie, here's a name that I think you have, my gosh, probably a number of things to say about.
Oh, certainly, yeah. Well, I heard Bowie before I saw him, and I heard the track Andy Warhol on the Old Grey Whistle Test. And if you recall, sometimes they would play tracks and they would, instead of having the band play, you wouldn't see the band at all. You'd just see an old black and white movie, you know, it's like an old silent movie or a Fritz the Cat or something like
right,
that.
Right.
Anyway, there was a silent movie being shown, kind of on a loop, and that music, and it just really caught my attention. And I went out the next day and I purchased Hunky Dory.
Right.
So this was before Ziggy Stardust came out.
Yes,
pretty early on.
Yeah.
And I remember, going to Spinner Disc Records in Abington Square in Northampton. And then I was like, I suppose, 14 years old.
Right.
And then getting on top of the double-decker bus and then just pulling out the sleeve. And that was the first time I saw Bowie once on the cover of the Hunky Dory.
Right.
A bit like Greta Garbo, you know.
Yes.
And I was very intrigued by that image. And then I read the lyrics on the top of this double decker. And I was just really, my little mind was being blown. And I couldn't wait to get home. I ran from the bus stop to my parents' house and put it on the huge old cheek gramophone.
Yes.
And played it. And that was it. You know, just lost in this other world.
What a great story.
And I found, well, that's what happened.
Yeah.
And then shortly after that, he came out with Ziggy Stardust.
Right.
And it was like, oh, wow, he's gone to this other place. So, yeah. Tell you, my best friend and I, Dave Exton, and his my best mate at school, we were really the only two kids that were into Bowie.
Right.
And we get picked on by the bullies for being into Bowie.
Right.
You know, so that was very bonding. We were sort of kicking against the pricks, you know. And anyway, we applied for tickets for the Hammersmith gig when he announced his retirement, and we got one back. So we ceremoniously ripped it up. So that neither of us, it was like, it would be too painful for one of us not be there. So there was an empty seat in that venue. And then I didn't see him. I didn't see him because I was always had my own gigs when he was playing near to me. So I never got to see him until the Glass Spider tour, which was not the best period, you know. But then I did see him later on, actually at the invitation of Tony Visconti in 1998,
right,
in a little, tiny little theatre just off of Times Square. And he was magnificent. He came on with Mike Garson, just the two of them. He had a 12-string guitar, Garson at piano, and they played Life on Mars, you know, and it was incredible. And then he added the band, you know, one by one. It ended with like a full band. But that was great. And we were also joined in our we have the little box seat by Mick Rock.
Ah, yes, yes.
As you probably know, took all the famous
photos of Bowie
in the early days, you know, so that was a fantastic experience. Because
yeah.
Visconti wanted to make a Bauhaus album. That's why I just had a meeting with him in his office in New York, and he was very keen to produce the band, but we split up again. So that never came to pass, unfortunately. Maybe, you know, still work with people.
Wouldn't that be interesting? Yeah. You know, you just said, David, you said something very, very interesting, and I can relate to only too well. There was an us and them situation, wasn't there? Those that liked Bowie and those that didn't. I can remember being picked on. I can remember just exactly what you were talking about. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you were actually beaten up. We were beaten.
Yes.
We were, you know, called queer. And,
absolutely.
Picked on by, and I think the bullies were actually, they were intimidated by Bowie. They were scared of that. And they were probably scared of something in themselves that actually kind of liked it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, they couldn't embrace it because they'd lose face within their little blockhead.
Exactly.
Gang, you know?
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Great memories there, David. Terrific. Thank you for sharing that. You know, over the years, you have worked with all kinds of people. You still continue to do. And as you say in your on your Facebook, you say, now flying solo with the help of talented friends. Over the years, David, with all the different people that you've worked with, has there been anybody that you would have loved to have gone into the studio with that you still would like to do that but haven't done that with?
Brian Eno.
Ah, okay.
Comes immediately to mind. I love his approach, you know, and very influential on Bauhaus. Huge influence on Bauhaus, not just through the music he made, but his ideas, his attitude, you know. Just an oblique coming out making music from a very oblique angle. John Cale.
Okay.
John Cale.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. What do you think about music now? Do you think there's still? I remember one time, I interviewed Bowie a number of times, and I remember asking him, "Do you still believe in rock and roll?" And he said, "Yes." And
it's amazing how it, you know, continually brings up new talent and young artists that are taking this what is now, you know, a pretty old form, but injecting it with vitality and making it exciting. A band that comes to mind that do this for me at the moment is a band called Starcrawler out of LA.
Okay.
And their age is between 18 and 21, and they're very exciting. Yeah. We actually invited them, Peter and I. Peter asked me if I could recommend, you know, an idea for an opening act, and I immediately said Starcrawler. So we did approach them, but when we're on tour in Europe, they're making their second album. They just came out with their first album, so we can't make that one happen. But that's an example.
That's an example. Good. Well, we're going to check them out and we'll get some on the show. Yeah. Music it goes through its ups and downs. And when you were first starting with Bauhaus, the scene was, in some respects, it was very different to what it is today. Technology was different, but in other respects, I just had a band on the show a couple of weeks ago out of Portland, Oregon, called Slippery Eyes, and their enthusiasm and their attitude was just it was just remarkable. It just was so sort of bright eyed and, you know, just, you know, stars in their eyes and in lots of respects. So, do you think it still stays? It's still there, that same sort of feeling?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's, you see, music is not. It's not as vital as far as like a vehicle for social and political change as it used to be. I mean, it has an influence to a degree, but not like in the 60s and 70s when, you know, a rock band can make a statement and it would carry a heavy weight. Now there's so much material, there's so much other kind of formats in circulation and on the internet that it doesn't have that same kind of force, but it can still affect an individual in a very deep and significant way. So it still has that power, you know, That's not to be sniffed at.
Yes.
I was going to say, just reiterating, really, just saying it's just not the universal force for change that it used to be.
Used to be, yeah.
But if you change one person or influence one person, then, you know, that does go quite a long way to influencing. It's sort of like you can change the world by changing yourself, you know, by increments. You know, it's still valid.
You mentioned a word that I just picked up on. It's great talking with you, David, because we can go off on different tangents, and just things that you're saying just drive me into another direction. You just mentioned about political awareness, and I'm wondering whether you as a musician feel that you need to say things from a political perspective these days, or any day for that matter. How important is that for David Jay?
Well, since the new administration has come into power in America, which is where I live, I feel galvanized, and actually, you know, I feel like it's really, really vital to say something about it, because it's so extraordinary and it's so awful, and it's very, very dangerous. And I've made several political musical statements, but I mean, it's one thing that's great about the internet is you can have an idea that is relevant to the hot moment, as it were, and make it really quickly and just put it out there. You know, I like that immediacy, and I have done that. You know,
yes.
I've made my little protest against Trump,
yes,
and you know, his horror show, and I will continue to do that and do my little bit, you know.
Do you think there's enough political statements being made by people in your position, musicians?
Well, it's certainly prevalent. I mean, I see a lot of that. I mean, the people that are going out and marching, I mean, in significant numbers, yeah. I think a lot of them probably are influenced to a degree by artists who are, you know, making the same points, and I think it's encouraging to see such the young kids going out there, especially like the latest wave of horrible shootings in the States. You know, those young kids going out and being so articulate,
yes,
and the numbers that have gathered in support of them, that's encouraging, because they are the next generation. You know,
yeah.
I think really with this administration, it's the last gasp of the old patriarchal, you know, old white man, you know. I mean, it is fascist. I perceive it as a form of fascism.
Yeah.
And I think its days have to be numbered. It, just by its very nature, it has to be self-destructive. It cannot carry on much longer.
Do you think it's a sign of the times, David? Do you think we have to go through these cycles, and we've now got to a certain point where, as you say, their days are numbered, but there's this last gasp, this last sort of...
Yeah, yes. I think it's... that's why it's so intense.
Your album, Crocodile's Tears and the Velvet Kosh, it's been, I understand, it's been re-released.
Yeah. Yeah, and not only that, it's been re-released by it's the label that originally put it out, Glass Records, which has been dormant for a long, long time, has been reactivated by the original guy behind the label, Dave Barker, as Glass Modern. And I've been talking with Dave, and he's going to put it out. And I've always had enormous respect for him, because he's in the mold of the classic old A&R man with just the sensibility and the ear to pick up on things when they're very new. And he just has that instinct, you know, and he has a deep love of, he's a music lover,
yeah,
you know, and he's a fan. And so it's great to be back with him. And not only is he putting that one out, he's going to put out my new solo album sometime next year. And also, we were talking about collaborations. One of the most fruitful collaborations I've ever done is with a band based in Detroit called Duende. and we've made an album together called Oracle of the Horizontal, and that's going to come out on Glass Modern as well.
Wow.
So there's three projects there.
Very cool indeed. Well, we've got to hear all of those, and we'll get you back on the program and talk about them. Whilst we're talking about music, and you've made a lot over the years, any real standouts for you outside of Bela Lugosi's Dead? Anything that you sort of look at in your career, then you go, that one and that one, maybe that one?
Hmm. Well, the album I just made, the solo album, it's a peak to such a degree that I feel like I won't be able to follow it, and I'm making it my last album. But it's not just because of how I feel about the quality of it. It's just I make these albums and it takes a long time and it's a labor of love. I don't make any money from any of these records because they don't sell enough, you know.
Yes.
They might be loved, you know, by a small contingent, and that means the world to me.
Right.
You know? And I make it for those people, and I make them for myself as well. But it's just, I was saying about the immediacy of putting something out online. I really like that. And I also love collaborating.
Yes.
It's very stimulating to me. So I want to do more in that area. But there's, now the first album I did at Beck, solo album, was called Etiquette of Violence.
Yes.
And the first track on that is a song called I Hear Only Silence Now.
Right.
And I've recorded a new version of that as a duet with a great artist, Emily Jane White. And it's a very different type of version. In a way, it's even more minimalist than the first one, which
right.
is saying something. But it's piano-based. And that will be the last track on the new album. So there's a completion of a cycle here. And it feels so right. So, that is a standout. That track turned out really well. It's very sonorous and it just has a lot of poignancy to it. So there's an example.
Let me stop you there. Yeah, because you just said this is going to be your last album. Why the last album, David?
Because it feels like such a peak, this record. It's the strong. I know it's the strongest thing I've done. And I recorded most of it in Prague recently, just mastered it there as well. And it has a very European flavor, kind of melancholic, distinctly European. A couple of tracks I recorded in the States. But it has this flavor to it that I think is beautiful. And so I'm very proud of it. And yeah, it just feels like a completion. So it's not like I'm going to stop making music at all.
Yes,
I've got loads of ideas.
Right,
but
right.
It will be more collaborations and just a one-offs. And, you know, I love vinyl, so I'm not going to stop making vinyl, but it'll be like singles, like 7-inch singles or 10-inch EP, something like that. And then, these things can all be collected and put onto a compilation album.
Right.
But it's just the whole idea of, you know, making a proper album. The last few records I've done have been kind of concept albums. Not that I, in any case, started out with this, I've got this concept. They sort of came together. I call them accidental concept albums. And it's just really reflective of where I'm at in my head and my life.
Yes.
Because the music is very immediately connected to that. So it sort of makes sense that in a period where I'm making a record, a year or 2 years, the content is reflective of where I'm at that time.
When's this
going? I think it'll be the last one. Well, I had to put it back because I'm touring so extensively with Peter, which is great.
Yes.
And Peter Murphy, and we're getting more and more offers coming in.
Yeah.
So I keep putting it back. At the moment, I'm thinking spring of next year.
Well, we're going to have to hear it. And obviously, as I said, get you back on the show and talk about that. I want to now switch to talking about being on tour and working with Peter. Again, we're going to take a quick break, and then we come back. We'll talk about that. We're talking to David J right here on Life Elsewhere.
We'd love to hear what you have to say. Write to this address, info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
My guest is David Jay. He, of course, is the founding member of Bauhaus, Love and Rockets, and he's currently in Portugal on tour, and you're working with Peter Murphy. Talk to me about being on tour and talk to me about working back with Peter again.
Well, I hadn't seen Peter or spoken to him in 12 years since the last full-on Bauhaus tour in 2006, which actually ended, the last gig was in Portugal. And it ended rather acrimoniously, and it was pretty bitter because it was always very volatile, that whole setup, which was part of, you know, what made it fiery and vital. It's like all the best bands have that.
Yes.
You know, from the Who to the Libertines to the Stone, you know, they all have that thing. But now, this came via the invitation of Peter. I was rather surprised, but really pleased, because I saw it as a chance for reconciliation, which it really has been. Mm. And we've had a lot of good talks. And Peter is an absolute delight to be around these days. I must say, I'm thoroughly enjoying his company. And he's still talking about a fiery performer. He really has that, you know, in spades still. And it's emotional going out there with him, because we've been through so much.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I feel like we've, you know, been in some dark places, but we've come through the other side. Mm-hmm. And that was always the thing with Bauhaus. I mean, that was another thing that bugged us about the label, the goth, you know, the goth thing, because we didn't want to wallow in the darkness. We were always aspiring to go into the light, but we realized that in order to really appreciate that light, you need to go into the dark and look at it and then hopefully transcend it. And I feel that this is transcendent now, even though it's not the full-on band. It's Peter and I and two other guys. But I love where it's at the moment. It's respectful, and we're acknowledging our past, but we're also infusing it with new vitality. And it doesn't feel like just trotting it out, you know. I mean, part of the reason, I'll confess, to do this is to make some money.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, yes.
But once we got together and started playing, there's an energy there and an electricity. And it's exciting, you know. And just like, I'm really into playing this music again, more so than I've been for years, actually. So it feels really positive.
I'm really pleased for you, and I'm really pleased that things are working out like that and that you're enjoying it. It sounds, I can hear it in your voice, it sounds like you're really, yeah, you really are embracing it. I'm looking down the list here of where I'm seeing you're playing for the next couple of months. You're in Portugal right now, then you're going to go to London, then you're going to down under to New Zealand and Australia. I see you're going to be going to Russia, to Serbia, to Switzerland, mm-hmm. Madrid, Italy, Poland, back to the UK. I don't see America on the list.
No, there's a reason for that, and that is because Peter has not been able to obtain a visa.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes, yes.
And I think, again, we're back to the current administration. They are not making it easy. Peter is, you know, he's converted to Islam a long time ago.
Right.
He lives in Istanbul. It doesn't help matters.
Yes, 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 yes.
And in particular, the relationship between the States and Turkey is not an easy one at the moment.
Right, yes.
So he's been, you know, denied this visa time and time again. And we just keep reapplying and hope, you know, that it comes through, because obviously we have a huge audience out there.
Of course, yeah.
In the States.
Yes. Talk to me about, and I don't really, I mean, go as far as you feel comfortable with, but being, performing with Peter, who's converted to Islam, as you say, do you get into philosophical talks? Do you have any discussions about religion or any faith or going in that direction?
All the time.
All the time.
All
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's highly informed. and knowledgeable, you know, and I really respect that. And you know, I've always had a fascination with different spiritual paths, and have, you know, explored a lot myself. So, you know, it just creates a very lively interesting conversation. Yeah.
I'm going to throw three more words out to you, which I've discussed with, well, I've discussed with Bowie, and I've discussed with a number of people over the years, and that's sex and drugs and rock and roll. The three things always seem to go together, even though it was a wonderful song from Ian Dury. I think we all know it. It's sort of like they merge together at some point or another. In your experience, David, does one outweigh the other?
Well, the one that continues is the latter,
yes.
Rock and roll.
Right.
You know, and that's the only one that's really sustainable.
Right.
You know, the others, you know... The sex and the drugs. I mean, well, the drugs. I mean, rock and roll wouldn't be what it has been without certain drugs, and the drugs have informed the music, you know, in a vital way. And the music wouldn't be the same without those drugs, and you can identify the effects of the drugs on the music very, very clearly. But you know, it's just like. Of course, it's a dangerous game, but certainly drugs have informed my music,
yeah,
and have been revelatory. But I've always, my attitude to that whole thing has been respectful. You know, sure, sometimes you just, I mean, alcohol, you know, is the only one that I will. It's a different. I have a different relationship towards alcohol than I do towards drugs.
Yes,
because drugs. Something, especially psychedelics, I've always viewed as a sacrament. And I haven't indulged in psychedelics for a long time, decades actually, but
yes.
When I did, it was from a point of view of respect, you know, and this is like something to be taken seriously. It's not party time. This is like a serious endeavor, you know. Sure, it's fun in inverted commas, but also it's serious fun. But alcohol is different because that can be just, you know, a good time. Although alcohol can also take you to a place that's deep, you know, and
yes.
Can be used as a tool.
Yes.
But again, it's just the whole addiction to those drugs, you know, and drink. And some of us, you know, are more, well, I'm just born with more of an addictive personality than others. I'm personally blessed in that I don't have that.
Yes.
But many of my friends do and have had, and some of them have succumbed, and some of them actually died because
right.
of that.
Let me ask you.
Sex is still good.
Yes. Yeah, I'm glad you added that. I'm glad. That's good. Let me ask you another question, David. And it's a three-letter word. Age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the thing with age, I mean, the blessing of age is perspective. And just when I think back to when we started the band, when I was in my 20s, you know, the things that would get me uptight and I'd be paranoid about, and they just, I have a completely different perspective on that now, and it's so much better. You know, you just sort of take things in your stride, and you just have what I know is a truthful perspective on how things are. So that is a real boon that comes with age. Of course, you know, there's like physically, it takes its toll, you know.
Yeah.
But even in that area, I mean, I've always kept pretty fit. You know, I swim all the time, and I go for walks, and also I think your mental state really, really has a big influence on your physical state. And if you are lucky enough, like me, to be in a position where you are actually have made pretty decent living by doing something that you love, then that goes a long way to keeping you healthy, you know, even though the profession that I'm in, you know, has its, we've just previously been talking about, you know, the things that can damage you. As long as you know, you're careful with that. The drugs more than anything.
Yes.
Then you can have a very healthy life, you know, and it's just an attitude. The best thing about getting older is just having this different perspective, and it's just a clearer view of things. But also the idea of mortality looms, you know, ever more present. And so you have a very different take on that. I mean, I remember in my 20s, you could get romantic about mortality, you know. Mm-hmm. And that obviously recedes when it becomes much more of an impending reality.
Yes, right. Yeah.
But it's poignant. It's very poignant.
Yes.
So it can also, well, it does inform your work, you know, if you're open to it. And, you know, I think of somebody like Leonard Cohen, such a great artist who had that quality of being able to look at his impending mortality and put that perspective and that complexity into his work, you know. So it makes the work richer, you know. And I like... A lot of artists that I really like are the ones that have stuck around, you know, because their work is informed by their experience.
Right.
I think of somebody like Lou Reed is a good example of that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Bowie as well.
And Bowie, yes.
Album.
Yes,
extraordinary, you know. And that was looking death in the eye.
Right.
Like, really, you know. And what a gift that he left us there, you know.
Absolutely.
Blackstar.
Absolutely. Well, very well said. David, you've done so much. You've done so much musically. You've done other things. And here you are at this point in your life. You're back performing with Peter. Life is good. You're embracing life. Is there something that you would still like to do outside of music? Is there anything that you just like crave that you would like to do?
Well, I am. Yes, there is, and I'm actually working on it, and it will come to fruition. And that is putting out a book of poetry, and I've always wanted to do that.
That's wonderful. Yeah, you like writing,
and so I have. Yeah, I love writing. Yeah, and I write more and more. You know, and I also wrote the book about Bauhaus, my memoir, Who Killed Mr. Moonlight,
right?
Which is something I felt really compelled to write, and it's. Well, it's cathartic to write that book, you know, and there's so many great stories in there as well. But I've got at least one more book in me. I know that.
I'm really enjoying this conversation with you. I wish, as always, because I feel like we're just getting warmed up right now, but we only have a certain amount of time to put on the air.
Yes.
So I'm going to stick my neck out here and ask you if we can chat again. And sort of just go off on tangents like we have now. Just chat, because I think that you've got such a lot of stuff to say, such a lot of things that we can talk about. Could we do that?
Sure. Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed it as well, Norman. Maybe the time would be when my solo album finally comes out.
That would be fantastic, David. I know that you're a busy man, and just to let everybody know, getting this conversation together with you today has been somewhat of a bit of a confusion about time zones.
Yeah,
and
many
and
different time zones.
Yeah, but we finally managed it, and it's been thoroughly enjoyable, David. Before we go, we haven't played any music throughout the show. We've been just talking to you, and as most of my listeners know, I edit very little out of the conversation. The only stuff we really edit out, as my producer says, we edit out your mumbling and grumbling, just meaning me, not you. So let's just close with a piece of music, and you can choose anything you like. It can be a Bauhaus, it can be Lover, it can be whatever you want it to be, and we'll get it from our library, and we'll stick it in to close.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go with the song I wrote when I received the news that Bowie had died. And that night I wrote this song called The Day That David Bowie Died, and I recorded it the next day. So that just poured out on me. I was in a hotel room in Portland, Oregon, the Crystal Hotel, which is where I always stay. And I actually got a text message from my son, so sad about Bowie, and I had no clue what that meant. So I called him up, and then he told me, you know, the news. And then, you know, that was a big one.
And
my little guitar was in the corner calling to me, and we got together and we wrote this song. And, yeah, I think I was really, but when we recorded it the next day, picking up, there was something palpable in the air that day. It was the effect, I mean, the effect of that passing was so, so huge, you know, and impacting that. I think something of that went into the recording of it. Some magic went into that record. So that's I put it on my last album, Vagabond Songs, and it was also a single. Yeah, it came out on A Recordings, which is Anton Newcombe's label. Anton Newcombe from Brian Jones' Town Massacre, and I recorded it at Colin Hegner's studio, Revolver, which is he was until very recently he was in the band as well. But anyway, that's the one I would like to play.
Thank you for just suggesting that, David. Unfortunately, as I said, time is against us, and I've just got to say so big thank yous to Mr. David J for joining us at Life Elsewhere. David, thank you very, very much, and all the very best to you.
You're most welcome, sir. It was a pleasure.
Boys were crying in the nightclub, a late night lamentation closing bar. I flicked my fag into the gutter. It fled and sparked like a shooting star. I'll meet you in the Buddhist Bardo. It's several floors above the club where we first heard the saddest disco. Traded dreams for a ticket stub. The ghosts that haunted Hammersmith are banished. Ziggy has retired now for good. With incense, prayers, and glitter incantation, the ending is told in old drawn blood. Where were you the day that David Bowie died? Where were you the day that David Bowie died? I was freezing, my eyes off on corner, in a far-flung northern town, not shy of rain. Smoking cigarettes and drinking whiskey with a beautiful young girl, my Sybil Vane. Thank you. Jones, we go way back. Back to those adolescent seeds. Seeds that bloomed into a flaming love life. Seeds and blooms and flames fulfilling needs. Basement in the dark, I heard his album, the new one, just like the very first. And now in pristine, hot-ripped retrospection, it all makes sense, the cessation of a raging thirst.
That was David Jay with his tribute to Mr. Bowie, the day that David Bowie died. Thank you to David Jay for spending time with us, and thank you for listening. Coming up in the next edition of Life Elsewhere, a fascinating conversation about Al Capone, Elliot Ness, the Untouchables, and the battle for Chicago. I don't want you to miss that. And another interview you need to hear is my conversation with a band out of the UK. They're called Gad Whip. Now, a preview of that interview will be up on the next volume of Life Elsewhere Music. Go to lifeelsewhere.co for the airtimes. And don't forget, you can hear this edition of Life Elsewhere again at NPR One, iTunes, Mixcloud, and our affiliates. The details, yes, that's right, they're up at lifeelsewhere.co. Till next time, be well, be good, and always, it costs nothing, be nice.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Vann, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.